ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, if you're a watcher of US politics, it's all happening in New York City this week. We spoke earlier about the pro-Palestinian student protests in Columbia University that have now spread to campuses across the country. That ongoing war in Gaza has certainly taken a toll on President Biden's support with young American voters, a bloc that's been critical to his, very critical of the president's ironclad support of Israel. But apart from the student protests, the other fracas with political implications happening in Manhattan is courtside in the criminal trial of former President Donald Trump. Known as the Hush Money case, Donald Trump is accused of falsifying business records to cover up payments to silence porn star Stormy Daniels. The first witnesses took the stand in this criminal case with some startling revelations. Nick Bryant is a former BBC correspondent in Washington and author of When America Stopped Being Great. Nick, hello again.
Hey, Fran, another dizzying week.
Another dizzying week. We're only at week one, really, of witnesses in this trial. Already there's been some fairly, salacious evidence being offered.
Yeah, we speak so often of this being so historic, this being so momentous, this being so epic, this trial taking place just a short walk away from where George Washington was sworn in as president, which reminds us of the nobility of that office. But here we are talking about one of the most tawdry sides of American life, and that's the supermarket tabloids and their methods, and this method of catch and kill, as it's called. Paying money to somebody for their story, not because you want to publish it, but because you want to bury it. And that obviously is at the heart of the prosecution case here against Donald Trump, that he paid the adult film star Stormy Daniels, $130,000, basically to suppress the story that she had of this illicit affair with Donald Trump. While he was married to Melania Trump, he denies that happened. She said it did. But just to make sure, apparently, Donald Trump allegedly paid her this $130,000 to silence her. And that was the focus of the first week proper of this trial.
And we heard a lot from a guy called David Pecker, who's the editor of National Enquirer. I mean, it was eye-opening to me that obviously National Enquirer does this catch and kill all the time. And he seemed happy to say he was regularly doing it and on the lookout for Donald Trump and named a few big payments that he'd made to people to catch and kill their stories. And he said, in his mind, it was all about helping Donald Trump with his campaign, didn't he? I mean, isn't that the crux of this whole case?
It's not quite.
Am I verballing him, Nick?
Well, no, it was fascinating what David Pecker had to say, wasn't it? Because he spoke not only about this payment to Stormy Daniels, but also to Karen McDougal. She was a Playboy model that Trump, again, allegedly had an affair with, and also a doorman at Trump Tower who claimed that Trump had fathered a love child, a story that isn't actually true. David Pecker also talked about how happy he was to help Trump with some of the kind of ridiculous conspiracy theories that he was making up about his opponents. You remember Ted Cruz? There's a famous story that Trump sort of put out there that the National Enquirer amplified that Ted Cruz's father had been involved in the assassination of JFK. I mean, it was crazy stuff. But the National Enquirer were happy to publish it because they wanted to see Donald Trump as president. They were happy to suppress these stories. So a lot focused on this. But this case, Fran, is not just about showing that Trump made that payment. That looks like a bit of a legal slam dunk, to be honest. There's lots of evidence to back that up.
And that's not a criminal charge, is it?
That's exactly it. That would be a misdemeanor under New York state law. And what they've charged Trump with is a felony. So what they've got to show is that that crime was committed to conceal another crime. And they've come up with this idea that that crime was election interference. That's slightly vague. New York state law isn't that specific about that. They're trying to bring in federal law because it involves a federal election. That has created some legal problems for the prosecution. There are a lot of legal scholars who would love to see Donald Trump found guilty, but are saying that's the weakness of this trial. They're trying to show two things. The payment, that's simple. But if you're trying to show that there was election interference as well, that's more difficult. And Donald Trump's lawyer came up with a statement I thought was one of the quotes of the week. He said, "I have a spoiler alert. There's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election," he said. That's called democracy. That's the challenge for the prosecution, to persuade the jury that Donald Trump essentially committed two crimes.
Okay, well, they're at week one and they're still going in that, so it's going to be something to watch. Michael Cohen, I think, is up next week, and this word is Stormy Daniels will take the stand too, so we'll see. This is the first of his four trials. You've told us before that, you know, this is really regarded as the weakest case against him. The Supreme Court is ruling on a far more serious case related to his role in inciting the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Donald Trump is arguing presidential immunity from his actions at the time. We've now got some hints on what the justices are likely to do about this, and it seems to be playing to Donald Trump's hands.
Oh, Fran, this was absolutely fascinating. When the Supreme Court took up this claim that Donald Trump should enjoy presidential immunity, it was really seen as a kind of bit of a formality. It would slow things down. It would gum up the works. It would throw a bit of a spanner in the works. It would mean perhaps that this trial would get delayed until after the election. But the Supreme Court would say, of course, the president doesn't have immunity. You know, nobody in America should have immunity from prosecution. And what was surprising about the hearing that we had in the Supreme Court this week was how seriously the justices, the right-wing justices on the court in particular, decided to take up this case. They are really fascinated with the idea of presidential immunity. They wanted to make a distinction between immunity in a private capacity as president and immunity as an official capacity as president. The idea that they would just say, basically, you know, nobody has immunity, and we'll throw this out and just send it back to the lower courts. That did not happen. They are taking this very seriously, which means that they will take a lot of time to adjudicate it. And what was extraordinary to hear was Donald Trump's lawyer actually at one point said, you know, a president would even have immunity if he ordered a hit on a political rival. Now, what was extraordinary about that was that it wasn't laughed out of court. And one of the right-wing justices, Samuel Alito, really sort of said, I'm going to leave aside the sort of specifics of the Trump case in here. I want to argue this more in the abstract. I want to sort of set down a general principle here. And one of his quotes is quite extraordinary. If an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy? Now, why that is extraordinary is he is thinking about a hypothetical when what we are talking about here is real life. We are talking about an American president who incited a crowd to attack the U.S. Capitol to overturn an election he has lost. The facts of this case are so relevant. But what Alito was trying to do was saying the facts of this case should be put aside. We need to talk about the general principle here. We need to write the kind of constitutional rule book. And that was startling to many Supreme Court watchers.
And Nick, we've just got a minute to the news, but I think we should mention the New York campus unrest. We've been talking about it here this morning because it feeds into the Democrats' electoral prospects. Joe Biden, we know, is losing support from his Democrat base over the war in Gaza. The youth turned out big time for him. There seems to be a lot of politicising of this going on. We even had the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, calling for the sacking of the president. What is happening here? Just very briefly, we're almost out of time.
Well, look, I mean, I think the campus unrest is really bad news for the Democrats. It reminds people of 1968, 1972. There was a lot of campus unrest then. It really played into Republican hands. They could go on this kind of law and order ticket. It meant that a lot of students didn't vote Democrat. 68, 72, obviously the Democrats lost both of those elections. So it's a kind of worrying historical portent for Joe Biden. When there's a lot of campus unrest, and this campus unrest is spread throughout the country, it generally damages the Democrats. That's why it's a big problem for Joe Biden.
All right, Nick, great to talk to you again. Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.